this long enough that I can walk around?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so let's see. So I was seeking some different angle to bring to this, and I had the idea of using the recent conflagration at the American Academy of Religion as a starting point. And you probably all heard a bit about it by now, and there was an article in the last bulletin about it, and a lot has been passed around. But basically, the American Academy of Religion is an academic body that holds a meeting once a year where professors of theology chiefly, but members of the academy, come together to share their insights and research and thoughts and opinions and prejudices and whatnot about various subjects in theology. The academy has a very far-ranging program. It's a large body. They meet in many parallel sessions. There might be 20 sessions going on at the same time on different topics. They've never had or any discussion, to our knowledge, about the Urantia book, at least none that ever was actually on their program. Last November, at their meeting in Anaheim, California, they had what's called a consultation that was on the Urantia book. The consultation, I think you have to understand what this is in the AAR. It's not a formal part of their regular academic program. It is a meeting that is held once, or at most twice, for the purpose of allowing the members to explore the degree of interest there is in a particular subject area. And it's something they do on spec, so to speak. And the Urantia Book consultation was very much that. A past president of AAR, whose name is John Mayer, had been talking to another member, and I'm not quite sure which person it was, about various possible things on the program, and the guy said, how would you like to have something on the Urantia Book? And he said, oh, that's interesting. Why don't we do something on the Urantia Book? So they called up some of their friends around, and including a couple of fairly prominent people, and got them to agree to devote at least part of their life to reading some of the Urantia Book and doing a paper on it. Now, these were basically people who were not overly, as I understand, not overly interested in the Urantia Book as such, and were not previously familiar with it. But they sent out also a call for papers, maybe 6 months ahead, to let all the members know that there was going to be an opportunity to present something on the Urantia Book. And there were three people who came out of the woodwork, as I understand it. One was Meredith Sprunger, who's a member of the AAR for many years. One was Jim Mills, who is a member for a few years since he started getting his degree in theology. And the third was a man named John Collins, who is a theology professor at Wake Forest University. Sort of. So with these submissions, that is the solicited submissions and the ones that came in response to the call for papers, they put together a consultation. And I guess what I'd like to talk about briefly is give you an idea of what went on. And then I'd like to take one of the papers in particular and examine what was actually said, what was done, let you see the actual style of argument that was used at this. I think it's important to understand that a consultation, basically this was an invitation to people to present their opinions without a whole lot of emphasis on academic substantiation, which was just as well because there isn't much academic text you can turn to about the Urantia Book to substantiate anything. But what I'll do is just talk briefly about what was talked about and then get into this individual paper. The theme is academic confrontations with the Urantia Book, and tonight we're talking about the theological viewpoint of it. Okay, I didn't put John Mayer's name up there. He was the guy who organized this. These are the five topics. Meredith spoke first. His theme was the Urantia Book and religious studies, and Meredith gave a real pep talk for the Urantia Book that was sort of oriented towards drumming up interest among theology students in getting into the Urantia Book. And he gave one of the points in his talk was a long list of good subjects for a PhD thesis based on the Urantia book. It just, you know, just in case anyone in the audience was looking around for a subject to write a PhD thesis on. So Meredith's tone was quite positive and unremittingly practical. And that represented Meredith's evangelism to the AAR. Write a PhD thesis about this book. It's great. And it has done great things for people, and it was very positive. The second talk was David Miller from Syracuse University. And he had this title, Urantia, Religion as Texture. Now, Miller is a fairly well-known figure in theological circles, and he is known as being a sort of ultimate cynic. He has a reputation, I understand, that when people take his courses, they come away feeling that he has discredited religion, or at least religion as they know it, by his scathing, insightful, and precise analysis of all its fallacies and problems. And it's clear that one of his concerns is that most of the religions we're concerned with in the Western world, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, to name a few, are essentially religions of the book. They're religions that derive their inspiration and sense of truth from a written document or a text. And so what he was concerned with in his talk was, how does the Urantia book fit into this tradition of basing religion on text, as opposed to basing it on individual personal insight, communication with God, prophets, etc. And he drew some rather interesting conclusions, and he said some things that, while you might think were a little cruel to the Urantia book, were also, in some sense, right on target. He said that the book was, this is the book to end all books. He concluded that any religion of the book that would grow out of this book, if it were true to the book, could not, would be iconoclastic and would be auto-iconoclastic. That is, it would be a fermenting, unstable thing that would not, even though it was a religion of the book, it would not be able to derive the kind of authority from the text that the traditional religions of the book derived from their text. He basically hates text. I mean, that was obvious that he hates text. And it was also seemed that if you had to have a text, it would be better it were this one than the others that were out there. But he just views text as, the death of religion, really. So his punchline that was in his abstract, that doesn't actually appear in the in his published abstract, but didn't appear in the talk, was that the Urantia book is not so much a text as a texture detextualizing all other texts. But that was really his way of saying that, it could not be an authoritative text, but would have to, and by its own authority as a non-authoritative text, it impaired the validity of other textual background to religion. So he thought those were all sort of good things about it, even though he hated it for being written down. And I'm not really, he gave a very erudite talk, and it was, he gave a very long, quoted a very long parable from Kafka in the middle of it, and so it was very highfalutin stuff. One of the more interesting observations he made about the book, and this is what I mean by taking cheap shots, was that he said, he pointed out that it had what to him were inconsistencies of approach. For instance, it had, on the one hand, all these beautiful and true statements about God and paradise and man's relation to God and so forth. And on the other hand, it had all this, what he viewed as mythological statements about the exact number of things there were in the universe and the exact age of things and stuff that he felt could only be fictitious in a religious text. And perhaps he's right. Perhaps it is. I don't know. Certainly, the book doesn't claim that the scientific part is authoritative. and that's where a lot of the numerology appears. But another interesting point he made that was perhaps funnier, he cited the bestowal commission given to Michael that he should take care to leave no written thing behind him and to leave nothing, no product of his own hands that could become a subject of idolatry in later years. And then he said, what do you have 2,000 years later? You have this enormous book, which was sort of the antithesis of that dictate not to leave text behind. Well, I mean, it is a point. I mean, we all have an explanation for that, but it is a point. It's a warning in any case. Well, that's enough about David Miller. It was amusing, but I'd like to pass on. You know, he was presenting his opinion that text stinks, and this stinks because it's text, but on the other hand, it's pretty good text as text goes. Jim Mills, we all know and love, like Meredith, has long been a student of the book and involved, and Jim has just finished his PhD, I think, from University of Florida or someplace like that. Maybe it's University of Florida. Anyway, he talked about a good Jim Mills topic, the origin and proliferation of reality, seen from the perspective of the Urantia book. Well, this was everything that Meredith's wasn't. This was, of course, highly favorable to the book. Jim started with the postulate of the fictitious primordial I am and traced the development of reality down to the manifestation of seven absolutes of infinity. And beyond that, it's self-explanatory, right? I know some of you have had a chance to read Jim's paper, and the thing that struck me about it was that it must have, I mean, it would have gone over the heads of most of the people who have Urantia books. And it must have been totally lost on the people in the audience who weren't Urantia book readers. But maybe I'm wrong. I just sense, you know, what does your average theologian get out of it? I mean, Jim has been talking to people about this for several years now, and perhaps he has discovered that people do get stuff out of it. I haven't had an opportunity to talk to Jim about, you know, whether he was trying to reach an audience or whether he was just putting a paper into the public record here. But there may well have been people who were excited by it, but it was a very high-level talk, you know, and it was certainly the most Urantia intellectual talk. The whole group. Well, the fourth talk was from John Collins of Wake Forest University, and it's on the cosmology of the Urantia book and contemporary scientific cosmology. I'm going to pass over this for a minute because this is the talk that I would like to spend some time this evening looking at in some detail, because it addresses the question of science in the Urantia book and the interaction between science and religion. And I'll go to, just to fill you in on the whole program, to Thomas Clark. I'll see if I can remember his affiliation. No, it's escaped me. It'll come back. The God concept of the Urantia book. And Thomas Clark is a fairly well-known Catholic theologian. And he criticized the Urantia book from the viewpoint of current liberal Catholic theology. And his general point seemed to be that the book was a truly moving statement of God's love for man and man's sonship to God, that it was full of much of great beauty, it was very evocative, it was solidly grounded in pre-existing religious tradition. But his complaint against it, and the reason he said that it could not possibly be a revelation or at correct, hinged on the fact that after reading it at great length, he concluded that it placed greater emphasis on the role of will in salvation than it placed on the role of grace. And this he characterized as the heresy known as semi-Pelagianism, or even outright Pelagianism. It basically amounts to the idea that man has to make a free will choice in order to be saved, has to choose to be saved. And he characterized this as a belief that is common in certain vulgar, it's a vulgar belief in Christianity. In other words, those who are untutored in the niceties of theology often hold to this idea, but that in fact the most advanced thinkers have never, and the church has officially never supported this. And he cited then the precedent going back to St. Augustine, who apparently was the first person to denounce the Pelagian heresy, and tracing it down through Kierkegaard and Barth. And the essence of this seems to be that while man has an illusion of free will in his choice of salvation, that in fact, by the grace of God, no one fails to make the right choice. I'm sure I'm trivializing it, but this seemed to be the general essence of the thing. And I had an opportunity to explore this with some friends of mine who are pretty deep into theology on the Protestant side, and they commented that basically he was complaining that the viewpoint was Protestant. That this heresy or this thing that he was criticizing was something that was one of the major points of divergence between most Protestant groups and at least liberal Catholic groups. Well, I don't know enough about theology to address that properly. Most of the comments that came through this came from the Urantia Book readers who had packed the room, and there were quite a few of them. In fact, you'll hear Professor Collins say that he thinks he's outnumbered by the Urantia Book readers in the audience. And it wasn't clear, it seemed that most of the discussion came from them and related to people's, what they viewed as people's errors in understanding the book. And it was clear that one person in the audience thought that Professor Clark misunderstood the God concept of the book, and because he really hadn't read the Jesus papers and understood the portrayal of unqualified love that was represented there, and if he had and understood it, then he wouldn't have said the nasty things he said about the book. On the other hand, having had a chance, I sort of felt that way too when I heard his talk, but after I had a chance to explore with people what he was actually talking about, I realized he was probably right, that there probably is a theological conflict on this fairly, to me, subtle, but perhaps not so significant point about the role of free will in salvation. I will not belabor the rest of the stuff. There were a number of, the general tenor was, of course, that there were three people, actually four, including the chairman, who could respect the Urantia book as a high-quality literary product, but did not think it was the fifth epical revelation, and they were saying some of the reasons they didn't think so. But they were presenting them more or less as a formal argument and trying to be as convincing as possible about it. Well, now I'd like to talk about John Collins' talk. And Professor Collins decided that he was going to somehow see if he could test the validity of the book from a scientific viewpoint. And he set up an approach. He formulated some hypotheses. One was that it was what it claimed to be, and one was that it was written by human beings. And then he proceeded to try to collect evidence from the domain of science and from the scientific literature that would support or refute these hypotheses, that it was either what it claimed to be or that it was a product of human creativity. Now, I will tell you up front, he concludes that it's a product of human creativity, and the basic thrust of his argument is that there are three areas on which it should be examined, and these are the origin of life on Earth, the origin of the Earth as a planet, and the origin of the universe. And he concluded that it didn't agree with what science believed, but that if you had taken a bunch of magazine articles prior to 1950 and tried to write a scientific religious story, you would have probably come up with something like the Urantia book. So that's the general thrust of his argument. I guess there are two avenues of approach to what Professor Collins said, and I hope that what I say is clear. I invite comments and questions as I go along. One avenue is the question of the validity of the way he reasons about the material, his reasoning process, his method of using the material to draw conclusions. The other is the validity of his sources in science, whether or not, in fact, the conflicts that he sees do, in fact, exist. I'm going to start with his reasoning methods, because that's really will let me finish the discussion that I had planned tonight, and then I'm going to migrate from that topic into the validity of his scientific sources, which will then lead into some more material tomorrow on the more scientific side of this. My basic position is that although Professor Collins says that his approach is scientific, what he means by that is that he is using evidentiary material, that he's using bits and pieces from science to try to prove his point. And that in fact his method in no way partakes of the method of science and is totally unscientific and does not even partake of the decency of common human reason and good sense. And beyond that, just to be inflammatory, I will say that I think that his approach, which I would characterize as rhetorical rather than scientific, or perhaps legalistic, it reminds me sort of a lawyer arguing a case in the alternative, as it's called. I've been sued for borrowing my neighbor's teapot and giving it back with a hole in it. And my first defense is that it didn't have a hole in it when I gave it back. And if you don't believe that, then I never borrowed it. In other words, Professor Collins' alternatives are not consistent with they're not consistent with the ways of argument that science accepts as leading to valid conclusions. But they are, I fear, consistent with the methods that theology often does accept as leading to, if not valid, at least convincing or persuasive conclusions. And if that's the case, it means that we're in pretty deep water when we start going up against theologians, because they're going to apply methods of argument that may be unfamiliar and may not make much sense. Now, what did Professor Collins actually say? He said, "I'm going to test the validity of the Urantia book as a revelation against the current teachings of modern science." And he said, "Science is authoritative. Scientists are the authorities. Therefore, if the teachings of modern science are correct, this book cannot be what it purports to be." Now, I want to set aside for a moment the question of, does the book claim to be authoritative in science, and just focus on Professor Collins' reasoning, because he was not aware that the book did not claim authority in this field. I mean, that one fact undermines his argument. But there's something else that undermines it, and it has to do with the way it approaches the use of its material. He said, "The book doesn't agree with the teachings of modern science, so if the teachings of modern science are normative, the book cannot be what it claims to be." Fine. If you believe that, then his second argument doesn't make much sense. Because his second argument says it does agree with the teachings of science 30 years ago. Now, let's not worry about whether it actually does or not. And because it does agree with the teachings of science 30 years ago, it must have been made up by people who were reading science textbooks then. But 30 years ago, someone applying Professor Collins' method would have concluded that the teachings of science 30 years ago were normative, and therefore would have been unable to complete the refutation. I mean, he, by showing that the scientific evidence has flip-flopped in a period of 30 years, he has, in effect, undermined his claim that the scientific thoughts of the current time should be taken as normative. Now, I'm exaggerating this point. I mean, in spite of this logical fallacy in what he's saying, there is a reason, I mean, there is a flow to this argument that is compelling to people. It's compelling to Professor Collins, and it's compelling to a lot of other people. And it does represent a way of presenting arguments that is used to convince people of a position that you really cannot argue in a convincing and logical way. In other words, he's saying, well, when you look at it this way, look at it this way, I see a pattern of relationship that would suggest that's all consistent with it being made up 30 years ago. I think as a rhetorical argument, it has a certain validity. But as a scientific or logical argument, it falls apart. If you look at what he really said and how he used the evidence, it just is it's internally inconsistent. So it's not a scientific argument, it is a theological argument. It's a rhetorical argument. It's the kind of argument I used to make in a high school debating contest. You know, where I could debate the pro or I could debate the con, and I had my quotations for whichever one it was, and you know, and the best thing was that I could be sarcastic and slice the other guy apart. Well, I guess, you know, a lot of people think we should be seeking contact with these people. We should be showing them the U-book and turning them on to it. And boy, isn't this great. And perhaps we should. But we have to be prepared for a lot of people approaching it this way, which is really not, I feel, not approaching it with an open mind, but approaching it with a semi-closed mind, that is a mind that's closed to certain things, and then going and seeking fairly elaborate justifications for a viewpoint that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I really think that's what Professor Collins has done. Incidentally, Professor Collins had the Urantia book about as long as I have, but he didn't read it very much. He got the book when he had just sort of graduated from college and was in the process of going into theological studies, and that he had read some of it at the time and had dipped into it from time to time after that, but had never really become involved in studying it. You know, if I were being real sarcastic, I would say that he had made a valid theological argument in front of an audience of his peers, and he could then pass out his resume looking for a better job. I'm sure his motivations were not at that level, but this is the academic community, this is an academic conference, and a lot of what is going on here is people really trying to put their best foot forward in terms of just style of academic argument, style of presentation, style of analysis, to show, you know, not necessarily they have a handle on truth or to convince anybody of what the truth is, but to show that they would make a good college professor, put it bluntly. There's one other aspect of this theological thing I'd like to point out, and it could be something one could spend the next few weeks fighting over. It came up a lot, and this is before I turn to the actual scientific material in Professor Collins's talk. It also reflects on the way the theological community approaches something like this. Several of the speakers, not Professor Collins, but Professor Mayer and Professor Clark and Professor Miller, all commented that, well, they said variously things like, the book is written in sexist language, or the book is a sexist document, or the book is a racist document. These comments about sexist language and a racist viewpoint came up from all three of these people in criticizing the book. I think you have to recognize that all three of these people represent a quite liberal viewpoint in the theological community. But from that viewpoint, those criticisms are not wrong. Now that's a little hard to swallow, but they're not crazy to say that, because that viewpoint is it is a viewpoint that to a lot of people would be viewed as a little extreme, but in the context that they're speaking from, The language is sexist. Talking about God as a father is sexist to a lot of liberal modern theologians. And the fact that the book explains why and justifies it, in their mind, to many people, this question of language is a political issue. And they have a problem with anything that's presented in language that they find unacceptable. Now, I'm by no means suggesting that we should rewrite the book, but I'm just saying that we know that what it has to say is not sexist, but to a lot of people, it is going to be misunderstood in that. When it's looked at the surface of the language, it's going to be taken that way. And the language is, I think, as Dr. Miller says in his talk, it is a product of theological thought in the 1930s. I mean, in the choice of words and phrases for things like this. So I don't know if there's anything we can do about it or prepare ourselves for it or what we should do, but it's just another point that came out of this that I think we ought to be aware of as we contemplate having more contact with the, shall I say, the outside world. I mean, certainly these people would not say that the Bible is less sexist or less racist. You know, I mean, they would find these same criticisms in biblical and Quranic text. It's just that somehow they're disappointed that a modern revelation comes to them in language that liberation theology is trying to purge itself from. Well, I don't know what your protocol is here. Is it customary to have a break during these? Well, I think this would be a good break point.